then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 14th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Quick Edgar Steele update. On October the 7th, Cindy Steele appeared in court and made a speech to the federal judge in the case very strongly objecting to the federal informant Larry Fairfax's squishy plea bargain. She was heard in what's been described to me as a kind of bored silence by the judge, and she was ignored. On October the 8th, once Cindy was out of the courtroom, Fairfax's guilty plea was accepted anyway, and his sentencing was set for December the 16th, i.e. after Edgar Steele's trial, so they can hold that over his head to make sure his testimony against Ed Steele toes the line. Presumably, his sentence will be significantly lighter if Steele, the primary target of the so-called investigation, is convicted. If he is acquitted, because basically the jury just plain doesn't believe Fairfax or his FBI handlers, presumably the judge will sock it to Fairfax with the full 10 years. On October the 7th, Cindy Steele also requested verbally and via a court motion that the no-contact order between herself and her husband be voided. She was ignored. The judge didn't even rule on it. So never let it be said that our judicial system is unfair. Crime victims and the families of the unjustly accused defendants are given every opportunity to speak their piece and to voice their concerns, as the saying goes, before they are ignored and the judge and the prosecutor proceed to do whatever quasi-legal atrocity they've already decided to do. Steele's trial begins on November the 1st and will no doubt be drowned out in the media by the sound and fury over the midterm elections. We will, of course, continue to follow the Steele case here on Radio Free Northwest for whatever good that does. Right, moving right along here. I had hoped that my September the 23rd FAQ podcast would have taken care of a lot of the constant repetition I have to go over. When people ask the same questions or they come up with the same objections all the time, I simply refer them now to the September 23rd episode. But it looks like every week something comes up yet again that I didn't catch on September 23rd and I have to go over it all again, even if it's something I've already explained before. Well, guess what time it is? Earlier this week, I had occasion to repeat, once again, for about the 50th time, my position and the Northwest Front's position on illegality. Having done so once in writing, now I'll do it again verbally and see if it sinks in. I shouldn't have to explain this to anyone more than once, but then there are a lot of things I shouldn't have to be doing. Let's recap, shall we? This is not an order that I'm giving to you people, because nobody gives orders in the Northwest Front, not me or anybody else. That's because we are an idea and not an organization. One day, when we bring the Northwest Volunteers into existence, there will be organization and somebody will be giving orders. But the Northwest Volunteers don't exist yet, so let's call this a strong statement of personal policy, if nothing else. Now, listen very carefully to what I'm going to say to you all. The Northwest Independence novels are fiction. They are not real. There is no Northwest Volunteer Army. It does not exist. Before any such outfit can ever exist, there must occur a change in the entire situation in this country, in every aspect, from top to bottom, political, economic, racial, social, you name it. That total transformation has not occurred yet. It is beginning, but it hasn't happened yet, and it won't happen for a good long while. My nightmare is that some fucking idiot is going to be unable to tell the difference between my fiction and reality, and he's going to jump the gun, or anyway do something with a gun, and he's going to drag everybody else down with him when the regime decides to turn some drunken or stupid isolated incident into some absurd fabricated conspiracy to overthrow the government or commit some bogus felony or conspiracy to square dance in a roundhouse or whatever lunatic scenario of paranoid fantasy they come up with. In order to prevent that scenario, or at least to forestall it in real life for as long as possible, no one associated with the Northwest Front is to engage in any illegal activity whatsoever. Don't kill anything. Don't rob anything. Don't burn anything. Don't blow up anything. Don't destroy anything. Don't commit unnatural acts with anything. Don't cheat on your taxes. Don't even jaywalk or spit on the sidewalk. No illegal activity of any kind. Zero, zip, nada, nix, no way, Jose, not happening. Under no circumstances whatsoever will I ever approve of anyone breaking the law. If someone creeps up to your side and whispers in your ear that I have approved or ordered some kind of violent or criminal act, and then tries to inveigle you into committing a crime, then that person is a law enforcement officer. And no, this is not Harold has to say that in public to cover his ass. I mean every word of this, people. Do not break the law. However, if your brain has already been sufficiently scrambled to the point where you absolutely must break the law, guys, will you at least please refrain from sending me emails telling me all about it? This indicates to me that either your mother dropped you on your head when you were a child, or else you're a cop of some kind. Now, I think I may have done this before, but while I'm on the subject, let me explain to you guys how they're finally going to get me. I say things out loud that the government and the ruling class of the United States doesn't want me to say. The fact that I have a legal and constitutional right to do so is a matter of complete indifference to them. Our lords and masters want me silenced, and eventually I will be, but how? I myself do not commit crimes. I pay my taxes. Some years ago I was audited by the IRS, and I ended up owing the government something like $15. In any case, I don't make enough money for a tax wrap to be worthwhile, and I don't live some big, luxurious Reverend Ike lifestyle. My tax returns are actually perfectly honest, since I don't take in enough money to be worth concealing, so that's out. Nor do I have any other skeletons in my closet. No drugs, no buggery, my genealogy's been traced back to 1727 on my father's side, and pre-Civil War at least, on my mother's, and not a Jew or a nigger amongst them. Hey, the worst even the movement goat dancers can find to scream at me about is the Frank Collin incident, which took place in 1979, 31 years ago. I am, however, exercising my First Amendment rights in a manner that the government does not like, and that can be just as fatal as actually committing a felony. Ask Edgar Steele and Maynard Campbell. Ask Bill White and Johnny Logan Spencer. I'd love it if they'd just charge me outright with treason, and it wouldn't be a phony charge like so many they bring. I really am disloyal to this government. I could do a big Robert Emmett-style speech in the courtroom proclaiming the nationhood of the Northwest Republic before they dragged me away. But no, the faceless gray men in the gray suits who run things from behind the scenes don't want the authorities seen to be jailing people for their thoughts and their principles. So what they're going to have to do is to fabricate some connection between me and some kind of criminal act. And my guess, here's how it will happen. Someday, possibly someday soon, a young white boy or possibly a middle-aged, overweight man with a menial job like a security guard will appear at a shopping mall or at his former place of employment where he was fired or laid off, or, God forbid, something even worse like a school or a kindergarten. Remember that Fruit Loop Buford Furrow who attacked a Jewish daycare center of all the god-awful things? Full of cute little kitties and yarmulkes who sniffled and bawled all over CNN about the big bad Nazi man? Jesus Christ, what was going on and what passed for that damn fool's mind? Anyway, this guy will be packing a couple of semi-autos and he'll come in the door smoking. He'll waste some niggers or former co-workers or some illegal beaners who stole his job, but I can almost tell you in advance for 100% certain, he won't harm a single Jew. Then when the cops close in, right on cue, our mystery man will stick the barrel of his weapon in his mouth and blow his brains out, so no one will ever be able to question him as to exactly why he did what he did. Is this scenario starting to sound familiar? Guys, no joke, you need to go to Blockbuster or Netflix and rent a movie from the 1970s called Telephone, starring Charles Bronson and Donald Pleasance and a very young and fine Lee Remick. It gives a plausible explanation as to why men, almost all of them white males, go on these little shooting sprees. I honestly do think they get a phone call telling them they have miles to go before they sleep or something like that, but I won't ruin the movie for you. Anyway, then will come the kicker. The police will find my Northwest novels in the shooter's room. They'll search his computer and find visits to northwestfront.org. They may find Radio Free Northwest downloaded onto his hard drive, so forth and so on. I may know who the gunman is, but most likely not. My guess would be that when this happens, I will never have heard the man's name before, and I won't know him from Adam's house cat. But, of course, it will all be my fault, along with my wicked books that I write. If nothing else, I was sitting here sending him telepathic messages, commanding him to go forth and kill, all that kind of happy horse shit. And then in steps Morris Dees, or since Dees is pretty much retired now, more likely Mark Potok, or some other legal-type lefty Jew, who'll go running to the relatives of the deceased and get them to sign a retainer agreement allowing them to file a malicious and abusive civil lawsuit against me, trying to hold me personally liable for the behavior of someone I most likely will never have met or spoken to in my life. Now, this is what Dees did in the case of George David Lube and also a number of others. Officially, the legal doctrine here is called vicarious liability, otherwise known as the Domino's Law, because of a case many years ago where Domino's Pizza was soaked for millions of dollars in a private lawsuit because one of their delivery drivers ran into another car and killed somebody, even though the police and the criminal courts decided it wasn't their fault. Bear in mind that although Dees does like to hang his malicious and abusive civil lawsuits on a criminal conviction wherever possible, it's not necessary. It's entirely possible to win a criminal case and lose the resulting civil case. Ask O.J. Simpson. I know that doesn't make any sense, but then, as Sir Francis Bacon famously once said, the law is an ass. Anyway, once that lawsuit is filed, that's pretty much me disabled for a number of years, one way or the other, as the case becomes an all-devouring moloch that takes up all my time, all my funds, and all my energy, no matter how it turns out. That, of course, is largely the intention of malicious litigation, or slap suits as they're called, to make sure that the targeted individual's time and money and effort is so taken up with the case that he's unable to continue whatever constitutionally protected political or social activity the system wants to stop. The fact is, guys, that there is really nothing much I can do about this to prevent it from happening. I'm not going to shut up like they want me to. My books are out there, and they will continue to be read, and I have no intention of knuckling under. If they can't find some other way to fabricate a non-existent connection between myself and some kind of criminal act, then they'll try this one. But people, can you do me a favor? Don't help them shut me down. Don't break the law yourselves, and if you do, don't send me emails telling me all about it and demanding that I approve of your ridiculous and counterproductive behavior. Do you not understand that virtually every electronic communication in this country is now intercepted as a matter of routine by the FBI using something called the Carnivore system, which by now probably has been changed to something more sophisticated? Guys, let me remind you of a rather obvious little secret. If you really want the world of my Northwest novels, if you disagree with me that the time is not yet, now if you think, oh, Harold's just chicken shit, he'll never really start the NVA, and if you really do think that you have the chops to be a freedom fighter, and you think the time for the NVA is now, and if you live in the homeland, then there's nothing stopping you from forming your own NVA. Of course, if you try to do it on the internet and you send me email messages telling me all about it, then you're not going to get very far. But just do us all a favor, will you? The late Pastor Robert Miles had a little homily he used to deliver on this subject to the people he called Wild Eyes. He told them, "I only ask one thing of you. Don't take anybody with you who doesn't want to go." That's my attitude to illegal activity as well. It's your funeral. But don't take anybody with you who doesn't want to go, because that can be tragic. And if you think about it, dragging people along with you who really don't want to go is a dangerous thing to do in any case. Look, there is a plan, and it is moving forward. Glacially, glacially, slowly, way too slow, that I grant you. But it is moving forward. We have to take the time to do this right, because we no longer have the luxury of unlimited time and endless do-overs. This is it. No more practice swings. If we blow this Northwest business, the white race is done. And right now, all I can tell you is trust me and wait. I know that's not what you want to hear, but you have to hear it. Are we crystal clear on this now? Everybody on the same page? Good. Okay, now we go from the sublime to the ridiculous. This is from Mike in Pennsylvania. Hello, Mr. Covington. Last weekend, I was visiting with some sympathetic individuals who I thought would be on the same page in regard to the Northwest migration. The good news is that there were a few quality individuals there who are taking this stuff seriously and are forming plans to migrate. However, there are still those who want to cling to any excuse at all, regardless of how absurd, just to evade the topic of actually moving. I'm sure this doesn't surprise you at all. One of the excuses I heard went basically like this. Yeah, I really like that Northwest idea and all, but I just have one major concern. That area is located over a fault line, and when the tectonic plates of the continent start to move, it will cause things like earthquakes and volcano eruptions. I heard that Washington State hasn't had an earthquake in a while, and they're due for one, and that would be bad, so I'm not so sure about this whole Northwest idea. Well, Mike, tell you what, I'll answer that one with a straight face. You can tell your friends that actually we have had a few earthquakes here recently. When I arrived here in 2002, the state capitol dome in Olympia was still under repair from one that had done some damage a few years before, can't recall when. And when I was living in Seattle in 1995, I felt a minor tremor. And yes, Mount Rainier is actually a dormant volcano. And there's always a chance Mount St. Helens might blow again. So I guess they're right. They just have no choice but to remain where they are, sitting in front of the television and watching all our earthquakes and volcanoes on TV, while Pennsylvania and the whole Midwest gradually turn into a province of Mexico, like the rest of North America, and while they get older and older, and eventually they're carted away from in front of their television sets off to state-run nursing homes with black and Filipino orderlies who starve them and torture them for sport. But at least they won't have to worry about earthquakes. First music break. This is Mike Cross.
I was just 16, the oldest son, when my mama called to me. She said, here's $10 and your daddy's watch and the Bible of the family. Now the mule's been sold, I'm feeling old. We got to find another town. You better leave and find you a better life before the family drags you down. And she said, is the whole paint peeling and the rats are squealing? The well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling lit, and we got to be moving on. The whole paint peeling, rats are squealing, there ain't no time for school. I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. I took that money and I ran away, but I stopped to see that girl of mine. I gave a preacher $10 just to tie the knot right after we crossed the state line. I got a job sharing crops for a rich Georgia farmer. I was young and I was strong. Tried to find a better life, but it won't no time till the kids started coming along. They were singing, old paint peeling and the rats are squealing. The well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling lit, and we got to be moving on. Our old paint peeling, the rats are squealing. There ain't no time for school. I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Town working hard to keep away the cold. My children had to help me bring the crops in, cause I was getting old. And then one night I heard my wife calling to my oldest son. She said, here's $10 and your daddy's watch. You better leave before the rising sun. And she said, it's the old paint peeling and the rats are squealing. The well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling late, and we got to be moving on. My old paint peeling, the rats are squealing, there ain't no time for school. I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Oh, you know I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Yeah, the old paint peeling, yeah, the old paint peeling.
I've gotten a number of questions from listeners over the past couple of weeks asking me how I think the Republicans will do in the upcoming elections on November the 2nd. And if a Republican seizure of Congress might actually do some good, at least in preventing Obongo and his Jew crew from completely chipping out on us all. Well, I could give you folks the usual knee-jerk speech about all system politics being completely corrupt and useless for our purposes, and that would certainly be true as far as it goes, but we need to start dealing with genuine politics in our strategy and tactics. And as silly and ineffectual as most of these electoral dog and pony shows are, like it or not, they're what passes for politics in this country. Also, there have been a few refreshing developments in system politics over the past few decades. When I was first coming up, Governor George Wallace used to say that there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two parties, and for many generations that was true. But over the past generation or so, a genuine divide has in fact sprung up between the Republicans, representing big business and the multinational corporations, and the Democrats, representing the organized, non-white and perverted minorities and big government. The red state, blue state thing is largely hype, true, but it actually has come to have some real meaning. Very loosely put, and always bearing in mind that Republicans are just as anti-white in their way as Democrats, the Republicans have become the party of the white conservative majority, and the Democrats have become the party of all the weird little racial, cultural, and sexual minorities, and what's left of the unions in this country. Disillusioning those white people who support the GOP is one reason we need to hope for a Republican victory. God knows how we could have forgotten 8 years of Jugyears Bush and his little Jewish neocon friends this quickly, but I think part of the reason is that our man-child president and his own Jewish team have proven to be such a catastrophe over the past 2 years that they've succeeded in accomplishing something that I would have thought to be impossible. They've actually made George W. Bush look good by comparison. This red state, blue state dichotomy has become even more obvious in that the once monolithic liberal media is now split into two very vocal factions who obviously really do hate each other's guts. The mainstream left-wingers like CNN and MSNBC and the old guard New York Times liberal types. And on the other side, the new neocon Republican media like Fox News and major talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. For some reason, Beck especially is absolutely hated by the lefty media. The mere mention of his name seems to send Arianna Huffington and all her ass-kissers on the Huffington-Puffington Post into a kind of St. Vitus's dance of hysterical revulsion. This may possibly be because Beck himself really is something of an outsider personally. He's a genuine peasant who has forced his way into the palace, so to speak. And yes, I know that Glenn Beck is a Jew-loving neocon. I know he's a ridge-running bush ape with nothing but pork fat between his ears. But you have to bear in mind that the Arianna Huffington and John Stewart types actually regard people like Beck and Fox News and the Republicans as the enemy. This has to do with our own complete inability to build an effective white racial resistance over the past 50 years. We should be the enemy in Arianna Huffington's eyes, not mopes like Beck and Limbaugh. Well, maybe the Northwest Front will be able to change that. That's one of the reasons I keep trying to break us out of the movement bubble and into the so-called mainstream. Anyway, getting back to the upcoming midterm elections. Presuming an honest vote count, and that's more and more a dubious proposition these days, especially in view of the massive Democratic vote fraud that took place during the 2008 election, thanks to Acorn and George Soros, but presuming that the votes are counted with some semblance of honesty this time around, I think it's possible that the Republicans may take back both houses of Congress. I don't think it'll be quite the huge landslide that some people are predicting, because I think we tend to forget just how increasingly normal white people in this country are outnumbered by the minorities and the faggots and the white liberal fools and a lot of younger white voters of the Beavis and Butthead variety. You know, the ones who voted for Barack Obama because they thought it would be cool to have a black dude in the White House. But still, I hope the GOP does get back at least the House so that they can become the majority on various congressional committees and start issuing subpoenas and investigating the regime and embarrassing the hell out of the Democrats. Remember all that fun we had back during the Clinton days? This representative from California, Daryl Issa, seems to have an especial case of the ass for Obongo and his Hebes. You may recall that this is what happened in 94 and 96 when the Republicans gained and then held control of Congress. All the Matt Drudge exposés about Monica Lewinsky and all the Whitewater scandal and the Rose Law Firm records and the Vincent Foster murder and a dozen or so other mysterious Clinton homicides, rape of Juanita Broderick, so forth and so on, none of that would have amounted to a hill of beans if the Democrats had kept control of Congress. Also, I'll be interested to see if the Republicans keep their promise and repeal Obamacare, or at least defund it. The Republicans need that subpoena power, and once they get it, they can start having all kinds of fun with that nigger in the White House, because he's got a lot of skeletons in his closet. I hope and pray that someone among them might actually have the balls to start investigating Obama's birth certificate or lack thereof, but that may be too much to hope for. Republican control of Congress will also lead to gridlock and force Obongo to rule by decree through executive orders, and I want to see what use he makes of that power. He's already declared more or less a backdoor amnesty by ordering the ICE to cease any immigration enforcement or deportation proceedings against illegal aliens except in cases where the illegal has a criminal record, and that's often pretty hard to establish. It's also possible that after the ass-whooping he gets in November, Obongo will call Congress back for a lame duck session and then just ram an amnesty through while he's still got that Democratic majority in there. It'll be, of course, totally against the will of the people, but since when has that ever mattered to the Democrats? Who knows, maybe the Republicans can use the issue of Barry's birth certificate as a blackmail lever and force him to back off on the amnesty and maybe even sign an Obamacare repeal bill, or else they'll impeach him for occupying the office of the presidency unlawfully. Well, I guess we can dream on there. But if Barry uses the Republican Congress as an excuse to basically stage a coup d'etat, completely ignore Congress and the Constitution and rule by decree, then eventually the Republicans, who are basically the rich, will feel their power and their money and their influence sufficiently threatened to where they'll be forced to try and do something about it, and that could get interesting. Finally, I want to see what happens when Barry and the Democrats try to force an amnesty down America's throat for the 25 million or so illegal aliens, either through a lame duck Congress or some kind of executive order that doesn't involve consulting the elected representatives. Now, that would be a clear impeachable offense, but they'll have to do that in time to get those millions of new Democrats onto the voter rolls by 2012, or else they'll get stomped at the polls again and lose the White House. Of course, if they do get 25 million or so new Democratic voters, the Republicans can kiss the White House goodbye. Now, that will be a serious threat to the Republicans, and again, they will have to respond to it if they have any sense of survival at all. So, we'll see how that plays out. Right, moving along to more important matters. Last week, I asked you guys to talk to me about your ideas for local organizing here in the Northwest. And this is from Dean in Oregon, Dear HAC. It was good to learn that you're going to talk about types of activity to help grow the movement and spread the idea of a white Northwest homeland. Here is an activity that can be done for those who live in college and university towns who subscribe to the monthly Northwest Observer. They can copy off multiple copies of the Birdman article, as an example, and leave them off at the local college fraternities. And by the way, for those of you who don't subscribe, Dean refers to an article by the late John Birdman Bryant, who is one of the best writers we've ever had in the movement. Believe me, it will be read by some of the young college men. The Northwest Front website should be printed on the master pages, so it'll be copied as well. Most fraternities in the Pacific Northwest are 99% white. Not only will some of the frat boys read the article, but some will take a look at the Northwest Front website. Some will listen to the podcasts. Some will talk about it to their friends and even their girlfriends. Little by little, word will spread. Another idea is to have the back page of the monthly pub specially designed to be copied and handed out in bulk with the contact info, etc., etc. As you said, this can be a slog and hard work. One possibility would be to have any frat house receive a 3 or 4 month free subscription to the Northwest Observer. This would mostly require postage and printing costs, which I and others could pick up. If enough of this activity is done in the Northwest, the PTB and college administrations and other Zog lovers will take notice, and word will get around. They'll be in a tight spot. Either they remain silent while we make inroads into the minds of the very young men that Zog needs to brainwash, or they go whining and spitting and hissing to the local controlled media, screaming about the evil racists corrupting the minds of their students, thereby giving publicity to the Northwest Front. I say any publicity for legal activity is good as long as they spell the name right. Plain old pamphleteering, other than the internet, is one way to go by way of bypassing the controlled media. These bastards can be beat. However, they will not go silently into the night while we make inroads into the lives of young college white men whom they think of as their own private preserve. As an aside, back in the 1980s, when Ed Fields was in his heyday, I used to order hundreds of copies of what became known as The Truth at Last, and had some of my younger college friends who had their heads screwed on leave them off in the college newspaper racks on campus to be picked up by the passing students. The silence about this was total from the college honchos. Also, our friend Kim has received an email from someone who claims to be some sort of assistant to you, seeking information about people in the area who are part of the movement, blah, blah, blah. We think this person is an agent of Zog. Kim may get in touch with you about this. This is a heads up on my part. No, Dean, that's Harley, whom I'm training to assist me with some of my emails so I don't get buried alive under it. Actually, that's not a bad idea, Dean, and if you want to send me some addresses of college frat houses, I'll be glad to send them 3 or 4 months' worth of Northwest Observer. I used to have my doubts about recruiting on college campuses because I figured that anyone sufficiently well off to go to college was going to be too invested in the system to make a good white radical, but I've changed my mind on that. I've noticed over the past few years that we're starting to get a lot of young college students and college-age people largely as a kind of reaction to the stifling atmosphere of politically correct repression on almost all college campuses towards white males. Someone once said that the last remaining vestiges of Marxism in the world are Cuba, North Korea, and the American university campus, and this seems to be the case. Sexually normal white boys on campus have a hard time, and a lot of them seem to be in the mood to rebel. So I'm all for Dean's frat boy idea. I mentioned last week that we're going to be spending a good deal of time on future Radio Free Northwests discussing the problem of actual organizing here in the homeland. I spoke to you last week about what you should do if you want to be an official contact in your area for the NF, or at least I spoke as much on the subject as I want to do in public, since we don't know who's listening here. Now I'll go into a bit more detail as to how to set up a local unit. But before I do, second music break. This is Rollins Cross. We'll be right back. When we do get to establishing proper units in the Northwest Front, they need to mirror the organization of the fictional NVA in the Independence novels. That was best outlined in The Brigade as the Trouble Trio template. Now, I didn't actually make that idea up. I cribbed it from real life. This trio idea is based largely on the organizational table of the Irish Republican Army, with some elements also incorporated from Cosa Nostra. Both of them are movements that have successfully stood up to full court press attacks by liberal democracy in an attempt to destroy them. And so this model is proven. It's simple, it's functional, and it works. A single person isn't a unit. That's the way that the movement has traditionally done things. They get somebody who's willing to list a post office box or sometimes only an email address, more often than not someone that no one else has ever met, and all of a sudden that single person with a post office box becomes a so-called unit. Now that's absurd. A single person may be classified as a contact if he or she fulfills the requirement for a physical address and understands that it's for public distribution and fulfills some other criteria which I won't get into. But one of which is most certainly personal meeting with some other Northwest activists so that we can at least make sure that you're not the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from the Temple Schmuckel who's playing a prank on us. And yes, things like that have happened in the past. In every unit, very little paperwork must be kept, only the bare minimum necessary to function. There should never exist anywhere in the Northwest Front any document or computer file which could, by any stretch of the imagination, be described as a quote-unquote membership list. It's sometimes necessary to maintain a mailing list for bulletins and an email list, etc., since few of us have photographic memories. I have to do that, but there are ways in which these can be disguised and concealed, and yes, that includes leaving bogus mailing lists with fake names lying around in plain sight for the police to find and confiscate. A number of you have suggested that to me before, and when the cops or FBI finally do raid me, they're going to be a bit puzzled by what they find, and let's leave it at that. Now, I have spoken before about personal recruiting. There's been a lot written about the kind of people that we don't want in the movement, both as leaders and as members. The Northwest Migration needs to emphasize just who we do want. It's natural, in view of the type of dysfunctionals we've gotten in the past, to seek normalcy above all else, but we need to think about this. In light of what passes for normal in this day and age, do we, in fact, want quote-unquote normal people? Now, those who still retain some vision of a huge army of racist beaver cleavers arising from suburbia need to rethink that. Revolutionaries are never normal or average people, and we have to understand that a certain amount of individuality and eccentricity is always going to be manifest in our best comrades. By very definition, white nationalists march to the beat of a different drummer. A lot of problems can be avoided by adopting the practice of recruiting and indoctrinating people on an individual, hands-on basis for activity in small 4- and 5-man cells or crews or activity groups, however you want to designate them. At any given time, any serious activist needs to be working at least 3 or 4 recruitment prospects. But what precisely should you be looking for when selecting potential crew members? The first thing I'd advise is to avoid recruiting in bars. Bars are places where drunks and barflies hang out, not revolutionaries. We need men with real courage, not Dutch courage. Don't mistake drunken expressions of racial resentment for true revolutionary sentiments. Anybody can shoot his mouth off when he's got a load on. At most, if you hear somebody making racist or anti-Obama statements while consuming alcohol, and you know where to locate that person, approach them later on and see if they'll make the same statements while sober. 9 times out of 10, they won't dare, and they'll actually become worried and upset if they think they might have been overheard raving racial heresy in their cups by someone who might turn them into their boss. It's extremely rare to find a single valuable activist who was recruited in a bar or other alcoholic setting. If their interest and their nerve comes out of a bottle, then sooner or later they're going to get arrested or otherwise forced to dry up, and they crumple like a styrofoam cup. Remember Glenn Miller. And by the by, just what the hell are you doing in a bar spending money on booze that could go for the racial cause? Another tip, concentrate on the young, but be extra careful. Some of the most passionate racists in America are high school and junior high students. This is understandable, since they're on the front line of integration, reverse discrimination, political correctness, racial violence, and racial chaos. The political and racial education of our youth, in order to inculcate them with white nationalist and Northwest revolutionary thought, is one of the movement's most important tasks, but it must be approached with great care and finesse. You can give these kids stickers and literature occasionally and target their schools for literature distribution as often as you possibly can. But as much as possible, avoid direct contact between adult party people and underage boys and girls whose parents are not racially aware. Do not allow your home or your apartment to become a hangout. Even for kids you know, they'll bring their friends and some of those you won't know. Then all of a sudden you got horseplay, drugs, messing around with firearms, underage drinking, and underage sexual activity going on, and guess whose head is on the legal liability chopping block for it all? And yes, I have seen this happen on more than one occasion, in one case with outright tragic results. Now bear in mind, people, this is not just old Harold sitting here behind a computer pontificating on and on about subjects I know nothing about. I do know. I'm trying to give you guys the benefit of 40 years worth of experience here so that we can learn from the past and you won't make the same mistakes I've made myself and I've seen made by others during all that time. Now, until they're 18, teenagers are more or less the legal property of their parents. It's the last vestige of slavery in the Western world. They have no political or social rights. And if some teenager gets hurt or gets in trouble with literature you gave them directly, or he gets in some racial fight that can be attributed to you personally, you can find yourself in a world of hurt, either through the law or through a lawsuit from parents who can sue the hell out of you for corrupting their little darlings with your evil racism. You can lose your home that way. It's happened. Ask Mark Thomas. On the other hand, we can't abandon kids completely. Now, the indoctrination of teenagers is essential. We've got to reach their minds and their hearts before the system does. This is one area where the internet will prove an invaluable tool. We need to keep them at arm's length and teach kids through general propaganda and outreach activity, not person to person except in special cases. Now, precisely when a kid constitutes a special case requiring a more risky but more effective hands-on approach, that's a judgment call on your part. Make a wrong call and the system has a handle on you they'll squeeze and twist for all it's worth. When kids hit that magic 1-8, they're free and clear. When you're sizing up a potential recruit, you need to be very pragmatic about assessing them. Now, what can this person contribute to the cause of Northwest independence? That's the very first question you need to ask yourself before you begin to work a prospect. Merely awakening someone racially or bringing them around to the Northwest viewpoint for its own sake, while it's always a worthy endeavor, should not be your first consideration during Phase 1 and Phase 2. Given our lack of resources and manpower, can we really justify the effort involved in converting an 80-year-old Social Security recipient who lives in a nursing home and is confined to a wheelchair, or a casual laborer with an IQ of 70 who earns $7 an hour, lives in a boarding house, and is mostly drunk on Thunderbird? Do we really need someone who's facing some immense personal or financial crisis, a bad divorce or bankruptcy or a medical catastrophe in the family that's going to take every spare moment, every penny, and every ounce of thought and attention he's got? Think, people. Look for those with skills, anything the NF might need. Electricians, plumbers, and carpenters who will eventually service party offices and facilities for free. Auto mechanics who can keep our people's vehicles on the road. Printers and copy shop workers who can provide free or low-cost printing. Computer people who can install and reconfigure PCs and other cyber services. Law enforcement and military reservists with all the variety of skills and access appropriate to their professions. Lawyers, doctors, nurses, people who own their own businesses and who can provide goods and services that the movement needs. People who own farms or rural homes where meetings and gatherings can take place quietly and unobtrusively. Building owners who can provide secure office space free or very cheaply. Now, the list goes on and on. Don't be afraid to look at someone and assess him or her on the basis of how much mileage can the Northwest migration get out of this person. I know that sounds cold and cynical, but it's necessary. You're not out to make friends and influence people. Well, yeah, actually you are, but you're doing it to save your people from extinction, not for your own personal edification. Lenin once said that a revolution is not a tea party. Now, materially speaking and numbers-wise, the enemy holds all the cards. Human beings are our only real potential resource. We need to cultivate them as such and grow them and harvest them and make no apologies for it. You're doing your job. Look out for potential financial supporters and don't be bashful about it or apologize for the fact. The NF has to have money to function. But we can't constantly expect the same people to bear the bulk of the financial burden. Now, seeking out and working new financial supporters for the Northwest migration movement is necessary. and it's a vital function that every activist needs to take on as a matter of course, again, without apology or embarrassment. There's no shame in trying to get affluent people involved in the movement to put their money where their mouth is. Okay, third music break. I think I'll go off onto one of my weird Aryan history raps. Now, a few of you have commented on my reference to arranged marriages in the Hill of the Ravens, which I won't get into now, but back in the old days, that was pretty much how it was done on all levels of society. Marriage was considered as an alliance between families, a financial and a business transaction, and to some degree a public affair that concerned the whole community. And if one judges by the social and economic results down through the centuries, the system actually worked pretty well, but there were some odd exceptions and mismatches, especially if you were in the upper echelons of society where politics was also a consideration. Every now and then, of course, someone just said to hell with it and bucked the system. In 15th century England, during the Wars of the Roses, King Edward IV, who was the first king from the House of York, that's the White Rose Bunch, fell in love with a young woman named Elizabeth Woodville, who was the widow of a minor knight who had been killed fighting for the House of Lancaster, and that's the Red Roses. He had to court her in secret, using all kinds of romantic subterfuges and secret midnight meetings and secluded bowers, all that rot, because she herself was actually a commoner, and for a king to marry one of his own subjects wasn't the done thing in those days. But eventually he prevailed on her to become his queen, and they lived happily ever after, right? Well, not quite. I won't go into the whole long story, but one of the problems was that Lizzie came with a whole crew of greedy relatives, and one of the things that the king's new commoner in-laws did was to marry their single sons and daughters into all of the noble houses of the realm, much to everybody's disgust. One of the more outrageous examples of this was the new queen's brother, Sir John Woodville, who was 16 years old. His family arranged for him to marry the wealthiest woman in all of England, the Duchess of Bedford, who was 80. Kind of a medieval Harold and Maude there. Now, this was a bit much, even for the 15th century. It was considered quite a scandal, and young Sir John wasn't too keen on the idea either. He fled all the way to France, and his family had to send a posse to bring him back and drag him to the altar by force. Of course, usually it was younger women who were forced to marry older men, like Anne de Courtenay, who was the daughter of the most powerful nobleman in the English West Country, and so to keep the father loyal, King Edward had her marry an older bridegroom, his own son, Richard, Duke of York. Anne was 6 years old. The bridegroom, Prince Richard, was 8. But sometimes older women did end up getting married for political and financial reasons to much younger men, and this is a very famous old English ballad on that subject. It's called The Trees They Grow High. This is Pentangle.
I was looking on my father's castle wall. I saw
Look for personal stability in a potential Northwest Front recruit. How responsible is his job? How long has he held his job? If he's unemployed, is his a genuine hard luck story of layoff or racial discrimination? Or is he just making up excuses to cover the fact that he's a bone idle incompetent who really doesn't want to work and who can't be bothered to get along with people on the job? Is he married? If so, for how long? If not, why not? How many divorces does he have? Does he pay his child support? Does he own his home? Does he drink to the point of getting drunk? If so, how often? Does he use drugs? If so, no, we don't want him. And what are you doing hanging around with a doper? How's his hygiene? There's something very seriously mentally wrong with people who don't bathe. How much television does he watch? What kind of shows? Does he allow his kids to listen to nigger music and act like quiggers? Does he live his ostensible racial beliefs? How about his political and racial outlook and conversation? How's the depth factor? Does he actually try to analyze why things are the way they are? Or is it just a nigger, 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 kike, 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 faggot, son of a bitch, goddamn Obama, Jews, that type of thing? How about his sexual attitudes and behavior? Does he get along okay with women? Does he appear to hate them? It's understandable enough if he does, given the increasing frequency of really hideous divorce and child custody experiences among white American males. But you need to make sure that his feelings are based on experience and not just because he's a misogynist nut job. You need to make sure that it's only the one particular woman or her lawyer he's bitter and twisted about rather than all women in general. Now, one kind of person I don't want anywhere near the Northwest Front is a woman beater or other kind of abuser. Now, this isn't just a matter of my own personal distaste. One of the requirements for a revolutionary is personal physical courage. Moral judgments aside, it is a simple fact that a man who beats women is a coward who's afraid to fight other men. And we can't have cowards just like we can't have drunks. A coward who has to beat women in order to prove to himself that he's a man will break under police or FBI pressure and he will rat out. Again, people, this is the voice of experience speaking here. If one particular known and habitual abuser and woman beater had been banned from the movement in North Carolina back in the late 1980s and the 1990s, then history would have been different and we all would have avoided a world of problems. I'm not even going to talk about possible homosexuality or sexual perversion. I shouldn't even have to mention that in this context. But, unfortunately, in view of our past history with people like Frank Cullen and Kevin Alfred Strom and God knows how many others, I have to spell it out. I got one word for you guys. No. If you detect the slightest hint of anything sexually ambiguous or weird or in any way off in someone, you do not approach them for Northwest Front affiliation. One final thing, and then I'll move on to something more positive. How is your prospect's religion? Look, I've said this before, we're a community of blood, not of faith, and we have to learn to tolerate all religious points of view in the NF. But part of that means we don't bring in people who aren't willing to tolerate. People with religious hang-ups are like drunks. They have something in their lives that's more important to them than the Northwest Republic. In the case of a drunk, it's his bottle. In the case of a religious nut, it's either his version of Christianity or else his hatred of Christianity, and that's another thing we have to be on the lookout for. There are people in the movement who are primarily motivated not by any concern for the future of Western civilization or any dedication to the 14 words, but by simple, fanatic hatred of Christianity. I'm not talking about pagans or Asatru who have a religion of their own. I'm talking about the Jesus was a dead Jew on a stick crowd. People who believe that Christianity is the enemy and not the Jews or the regime or the niggers or anything else. Now, these people are, some of them, quite brilliant in their own way, but they're not true racial nationalists. And we can't use them, because eventually their anti-religious obsession will come front and center and take over everything they're involved in. A good example is my old Plexus editor, Steve Kendall, back in the 90s, who provided invaluable assistance to my work back then, but I had to edit every issue of Plexus with a fine-tooth comb, because he kept trying to slip these little digs against Christianity in there. Now, he knew that the printer who was doing the magazine for us for free was a Christian, but he simply would not lay off. It was almost like he was deliberately trying to start trouble and lose us that printing source, rather than accept something good for the movement from a Christian. Anyway, I can't be messing around with that this time around, people. It's too important now. We're out of time. So what do you look for in a new comrade beyond some of the things I've mentioned earlier? Now, here's what makes me perk up and take notice of somebody. First off, intelligence. Does he read books? And it doesn't matter so much what kind. Does he have sufficient attention span and concentration to read a block of type for content? And if so, that right there is a sign that you're looking at someone very unusual for a white man or woman, especially a younger white man or woman. You're looking at someone who is not only willing but able to disengage themselves from the television set and the computer for at least a while. Now, that means that their mind and their character is strong enough to resist the temptation of the flickering electronic screen, at least on occasion. And that's a good sign. You might try checking out your local library and striking up acquaintances with people you see there regularly. Also, of course, if they read books, it'll be much easier to get them interested in the Northwest novels. Does this person have a trade or a skill? In other words, did they have enough foresight in their youth to realize that they would need to earn a living as adults? And so they actually prepared themselves for life rather than just drifted on through the years with a Beavis and Butthead like a whatever, man. That kind of foresight definitely is one of the character traits we're looking for. Now listen to their language. Do they talk like niggers or quiggers or Beavis and Butthead? Is their conversation full of casual obscenities? Now, if not, that's a green flag. And yes, I know, I'm hardly one to talk about foul language. But me, I'm getting cranky and senile, and I give less and less of a damn, and I do at least know better. If you find a young white person who is moderate and careful in their language, who seems to choose their words for actual meaning and not just make noise with their mouth, who never speaks unless they have something to say, and who avoids speaking like a nigger dope dealer out of the Baltimore projects, then you may have something there. Learn more about that person. If you can, observe how the potential recruit relates and interacts with animals, and how animals interact with them. Now, someone who loves animals is capable of loving his race. Cats and dogs are good judges of character. Really. Does this person already have any political or racial opinions? Do they ever talk about politics or current events, even if it's only from an establishment point of view? Now, if so, that can be a good sign. It shows that at least they're paying some attention to what's going on around them. If their opinions aren't quite what they should be, then it's up to you to change them through persuasion. Now, the worst white people to try and work on are the ones who go through life oblivious to everything going on around them, concerned only with their personal lives and interests, and who change the channel when the news comes on. Now, that kind of people are the ones that we're doing all this for, but right now they're part of the problem and not the solution. When you first approach a new recruit, try to personalize the approach through something that affects him immediately and personally, like when he doesn't get a job because an illegal Mexican got it instead, or when he or someone in his family is a crime victim or affected by the crawling chaos in some way. Show him how the problems in the system have caused his own problem, and then lead him on into a discussion about things in general. Now, I'm familiar with all the complaints that our people have made down through the years to the effect that ordinary, everyday whites are completely hopeless. Their skulls are full of mush, they have the attention span of a housefly, and they're as stupid as cattle chewing their cud. And yeah, there's a lot to this. But how much of the problem is also due to our approach? Now, do we not understand that when we approach someone in a shrill and excited tone, trying to force our desperate illumination on them, waving a pamphlet under their nose, or demanding that they immediately go to some website, we are the ones who look like quack jobs. The first step towards converting someone else to our point of view is to place yourself on a credible basis of communication with them. They have to like you and respect you personally before they'll listen to you. Now, that's why I've always been so down on anything that makes us look weird or foreign or eccentric. Now, this is why we have this nice, bland, but attractive-looking flag, with no strange symbols on it, just simple colors. Americans have been conditioned from birth to reject certain ideas, symbols, and terminology, and we have to master the art of blending in and sliding in under people's radar, getting into their heads, getting the hood up and rewiring their brains without tripping the alarms and causing the automatic reject mechanism to kick in. Now, next week, we'll talk more about how to do that. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.